All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the I'm a Rescue podcast. I am Tom Clark. Joining me today is Travis Clark. Travis is a renowned podcaster. He's an actor. He's a comedian. He's also a musician. You pretty much do it all.
I do whatever they'll let me.
Do you have like a salad dressing? Are you like Paul Newman?
I'm working on one. Yeah.
What would be your salad dressing if you made a salad dressing?
It would just be whatever in the kitchen, and I'll be like, this is what I planned. This is it. You're looking at it.
Travis, it's funny. So this past podcast, I interviewed a guy named Tom Clark. And then I have another interview lined up with a Tom Clark. And then somebody mentioned on my Twitter, you should interview Travis Clark, because I've posted this video a few times of being introed by the name Travis Clark. And that's actually how we met, was through this video.
I know, it was funny. A couple of people tagged me in it. And whenever you post that video, my favorite thing is I just sit there and I just wait, because without fail, somebody goes, who the F is Travis Clark? And I like to chime in, I am. Just every time is the comment, whenever I see it.
Right. You're getting roasted in a video. But it's funny because... I'll probably be posting the video, but I've posted it several times, but it's basically me being introed at this show in Phoenix, Arizona. It's like in a church hall. And the guy before the show kept saying like, oh yeah, Travis, you know, good to meet you. I worked with you a couple of years ago. And I'm like, no, it's Tom. Like, it couldn't be any further from Travis. You know, it's not like Tim or, you know, Jim, or it's Tom. And I was like, remember, it's Tom. And then he introed me, like, ladies and gentlemen, Travis Clark. And as I'm walking up there, it was the slowest fall ever. I trip. It's almost slow motion. He's like, oh, I mean, and then it's just chaos. But it's one of the funniest moments. Do you know who this guy was? Did you know that MC?
I've done some shows in Arizona, and probably around the time that guy would have thought that he had worked with you / me. So I don't know if I know him directly, but I probably had met him at some point. But that video, every time I see it, it's so masterful, the way you are brought up to the wrong name and your trip, that it is, you couldn't stage it. Like, it's one of those like comedy class, everything about it is just, it's almost musical in its timing. It's beautiful.
And the music, Born in the USA. That's right. So it's like, yeah, it's one of those things, like comedians always complain about not recording the perfect set. And that was literally, because I was recording a lot back then, and I just recorded it. I happened to have the camera at the right angle, and lo and behold, comic genius.
Beauty. And also too, I am huge in the Phoenix church community. That's just really where my demographic lives.
That's your wheelhouse right there.
Yeah.
Next church community. Yeah. And after that, I had to do like 45 more minutes of actual stand-up.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So
I think, you know, gigs that go wrong from the jump at the time for me were always like just panic, but in the hindsight are just some of the funniest things to me. Because it's like already the worst thing that could have happened started the show. And then like how you deal with it and what you found in those moments. Sometimes it's great. And sometimes in hindsight, when it isn't great, you're like, oh my God, let me tell you about this. I did a show once where a guy before me hated the audience so much that he kept yelling at these two women, and they burst into tears because that day their mother had died.
Oh my God.
And so then he started saying, well, then I'm glad she's dead because you're such terrible people. And then the whole audience turned. This is the guy hosting the show. And he goes, I don't know. Here's your comic. And then that's what brought me up. So I had to like deal with that.
Oh my God. I mean, I've just learned at this point, like the worse the setup, the better the show I have, because I realize the expectations are low. Right. So I take the pressure off myself. So that's how I look at it now. But I think in the old days, I would have been like panicked. But yeah, I think
sure.
you do it a while, you're just like, all right, that's fine. You can't go any lower than this.
Right. If this is the worst that happens, we're going to be okay.
Right. And then it was, so that was like maybe a week and a half ago, I posted that video. And then a few days ago, I posted, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, I did a promo picture, an old picture from like 12 years ago of me outside the Wiener Factory in Oaks. And the Wiener Factory, I just thought the name was hilarious. I lived down the street in Encino, and it had been closed down for like years. It was like just, but the Wiener Factory sign was still up. So I got Steve Agee actually took all the photos and put on this weird like bobsledding outfit. And I just stood outside Wiener Factory like I was a superhero. And then you told me that you actually worked at the Wiener Factory.
I did. Not to brag, I was the manager of the Wiener Factory. You know, I was no low-level Wiener Factory employee. I was the manager.
Who owned the Wiener Factory? Who decided, I'm going to call this place the Wiener Factory?
I can't remember his last name, but it was a guy named Kevin. And Kevin basically always hired people from my high school to work there. So it was, if you went to Notre Dame, which is in Sherman Oaks, mm-hmm. if you went to that high school, you kind of ended up working at the Wiener Factory. That
like was usually,
it was everybody's first job for a while. And there used to be three. There were two Wiener Factories. There was another one in Burbank for a while. You always heard legends about. It became a Paquito Moss. It's like on Olive. But at one point that was a Wiener Factory, and like, there were all these crazy stories that happened there. But the Wiener Factory in Sherman Oaks, I actually was second oldest person working there at the time, because right after the 94 Northridge earthquake, I needed a job. I just left college. And so I was working for all these people I'd gone to high school with or remembered me when I was in high school. So I became the manager of this hot dog stand. And it was complete chaos, because teenagers were in charge of it. Like, so it's, we would have a crazy, crazy lunch hour where, like, you know, you'd be opening the place at 10 in the morning and there'd be a line of people wanting food, but then we'd stay open till 9 p.m. but no one came after 3. Mm-hmm. So you just had nothing to do for like 6 hours. So chaos reigned at the Wiener Factory, and it was just insanity, some of the stuff we did.
Was Wiener Factory sort of, because In-N-Out Burger always struck me as the good straight A students go to In-N-Out. It was the Wiener Factory sort of like the path of least resistance?
You got, you mean in terms of clientele or who worked there?
Oh, the people that worked there.
The people who worked there. I mean, some of people went on to do like some really cool stuff, and some people ended up like, they worked at the Wiener Factory, you know, like.
Was there somebody famous?
But like, some people went on to, like, one of my friends went on to be a pilot. Another one of my friends is like a pretty established musician who tours and has local, you know. But then there's some guys who I'm like, I don't know what happened to that guy. Like, I don't know if that guy made it to 30. You know, like, I think that might have been it for him.
Then you said that you had worked on a pilot about your experience there, but you thought
I did, because I'm thinking about it, because at the time it's such a funny job, because when I was 19, 20 and working that job, I remember saying things like, God, man, how am I supposed to like pursue acting if I have to work 20 hours a week? Like, like the idea of having to go to a place for 5 hours a day, 4 days a week was just messing up my life. Right. And and not making me happy. But in hindsight, like, the amount of like funny things that happened there, or funny things that happened because of the people you knew there. And also, there were people who at the time only knew me, like there were friends I had made at the time, only knew me as the guy who worked there. And they just gave me endless crap about smelling like hot dogs. Because if you worked there, it didn't matter how much you showered, you always smelled like hot dogs. Always.
Right. You don't want to walk into an audition smelling of hot dogs.
Or a date, or a party, or like, you know, just everywhere you go, you're like, who brought hot dogs? And that's just me. Why do you smell like that? I work at the Wiener Factory. You work at what? It's not, no, it's a hot dog stand.
Right. Yeah, it's too much.
So
yeah,
had you never gone there, like, other than taking that photo?
No, never had gone there. Just fascinating.
So inside there was all of this like graffiti, or it was stupid jokes like written in marker. Uh-huh. And so it's like one of the artists from Mad Magazine drew something, like a piece of art that we kept painting around. It'd been there for like 30 years by the time I worked there. And then, like, you know, Megadeth had come in and like signed the wall. And then there was all of these like silly jokes, like Vincent's van goes, you know, like just bad puns, you know, quote unquote dad jokes now, but just lined the wall, and people would think of them and submit them to me. I was like, I don't care about, I'm not writing that on the wall, and I don't care. Like, right. This is just a job, man.
Right. Yeah. It was, well, yeah, I was just always blown away by it, because it was just always, it was just standing. It was just nobody opened anything. Do you know what year it closed?
I want to say 05, maybe 06.
Oh my God.
I want to say it was open till that long. Maybe 04, somewhere around there.
Because I took that photo in 2008 or 2009, so it had been shut down forever.
It was, the building itself used to be like the where you would go in to buy a used car. So that used to be a car lot, and that's where you would go sign the paperwork for whatever jalopy you just bought. Uh-huh. Then they divided the line, and one side's a liquor store, and then one side was the Wiener Factory, and it was the Wiener Factory for like 40 years, maybe 35. Then it was going to be... what was the yogurt everybody did for a while? Pinkberry. It was going to be a Pinkberry for a while. Uh-huh. And now it's like a hookah lounge, I think.
I think so, yeah.
It's some weird bar thing. And I'm telling you, the walls were permeated with wiener smell. Like, there's no way to escape it. So I don't know what they did, because it didn't knock the building down. They just put more stuff around it.
Right. I love if it's a hookah lounge. Like, this is all we can do. We can do a hookah lounge. It'll drown out the wiener smell.
I would also love it if, like, in the hookah water is like hot dogs, you know, just the whole time. It's just
just hot dog based hookahs. But yeah, so you grew up out here in, mm-hmm. Los Angeles. Okay. And I'll say Travis's dad is Blake Clark, who's a great actor and has had an amazing life, not just career, but just life.
Yeah.
Veteran and the 101st Airborne, right?
5th Division. I think somewhere online, all the info about my dad online is really funny, because it's usually wrong. In fact, they put him in the wrong... he was in the 5th Infantry. I know that. I don't know where the 101st Airborne came from. But for a while, if you went to my dad's Wikipedia page, it said that my dad was a single father with one adopted child. I have a brother. My mother is alive. I'm not adopted. So it was like, I read this one time and I went, what? And I was out to dinner with my mom, my dad, and my brother. And I went, who are these people? Because according to Wikipedia, they don't exist. So it's always funny when I see that info. It's like, I think they had him born in the wrong state, in the wrong year. Yeah, so don't trust anything you read online.
So he came over from Georgia, mm-hmm. Moved to LA. When did he come over?
1980. Yes, because we moved the same year, but like 6 months later. So he moved out here probably the beginning of the year, and we moved out Grapes of Wrath style in a jalopy with everything strapped to the side of a car crossing the entire country at summer of 1980. So I moved out here in, I think we arrived in August 1980.
Was that a cool move at the time? Because you're like living in Georgia and you think California, is that exciting?
It was weird for me because I was in kindergarten. So I didn't have like necessarily a ton of friends that were like, my identity was in Georgia, mm-hmm. but it was also a pretty big upheaval because it was, well, you know, I'm still a kid going from one place to another. Like Macon, Georgia and the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles are very different places, especially in 1980. So I came out here, I had a weird Southern accent. All the kids made fun of me, uh-huh. you know, because I was like, oh, I stepped on the cement. And they're like, you stepped on the what? The cement? And they would call me a redneck and they'd throw me in garbage cans. And oh, so, yeah, it was a bit of a...
Wow.
California is not as progressive when it comes to elementary schools. It turns out kids do not like outsiders.
The great equalizer, yeah.
Exactly.
That must have been, what was your dad sort of summoned to LA? Like, look, you got to get out here because it's going to happen for you? Or was it a big leap of faith or what?
It was a bit of a leap of faith. It was sort of this, at least as I understand it. I mean, from my point of view as a kid, the guy who took me camping and the guy I played with all day left for 6 months, which felt like forever. Mm-hmm. So I was just super depressed all the time from what my mom tells me. She was like, we tried putting you in like other places to play with kids and other daycares, and you just like were just super depressed. And I was like, I feel like I've just always been depressed, but that might just be my default setting. Right. But no, he moved out here because it was, I have this desire to do this. Let's see if it's possible. So he moved out here and gave it 6 months to see how it settled, how it felt. And so it was like the 6 months went by and he went, pack it up and come out. And then really, it's funny to think about, since, you know, I ended up trying to pursue similar things as I grew up. Success for my father, at least from my point of view, came really quickly. Like, he was doing television shows, I don't know, a year after moving out here. He was, you know, getting, you know, like day player parts on whatever TV show was around. And I was a huge fan of the show Greatest American Hero when I was a kid. And my dad got a role on that and got William Catt, who was the star of that show, to sign a birthday card to me. So like, that just blew my mind that like, I went from watching these people on TV to like, that guy sent me a birthday card, you know, just unreal. Right. And you know, my dad during the day worked at a t-shirt store and at night worked the door at the Comedy Store. So he would, until he became like a regular and kind of got more regular work in general. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it was touch and go when we moved out here. Like, our dining room table in quotes was an ironing board. So we didn't have enough furniture when we moved out here. So you'd be eating dinner and it was an old ironing board. And if it gave out, the floor, you know, the table would fall to the floor and you'd have to follow the food to the bottom because you couldn't. Yeah, it was tough going for a few years.
Yeah, I mean, that's, what was I going to say about, well, first of all, it reminds me of like the Beverly Hillbillies, the passing things with the pool cues. And yeah, it's, what was it, that the fact that he was out here in the 80s, what was it about the, trying to remember, there's something that you triggered with when you said that about, I remember that in his stand-up, I remember one of his big bits was thinning the herd. We got a thin.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that was hacked by so many comics. But to me, I always attribute it to him. Was that, what was that like? That was sort of his calling card, I guess.
It was. And it was funny when I started doing stand-up. I started kind of in the early 2000s is when I finally, like, I kind of resisted doing comedy for a long time because I was like, that's what my dad does. I don't want to do what my dad does. And mm-hmm. then everyone's like, you should try it. And then I tried it and I was like, I should have not tried it. but I was doing an open mic out here in the Valley. There used to be the Sportsman's Lodge used to have an open mic on the patio. Did you ever do that one, Tom? The Patio of the Stars?
I avoided it. I remember it and I was like, no.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of the Wiener Factory of open mics. It was like one of the things that we were like, this is kind of hellish and crazy. But in hindsight, like, I actually have some really funny memories. So one time I'm sitting in the audience and this guy comes up, older guy, probably in his late 50s, early 60s, starts doing all these thin the herd jokes. And I was just like, what the hell? And so no one knows who I am at this point. I made a point to never really like mention who my dad was, not out of embarrassment, but just out of like, I didn't want to seem like I was, I don't know, had my own thing going on. So the guy's just doing thin the herd. And I just went, come on, man. He goes, what's your problem? And I was like, you're doing my dad's joke. And he goes, what are you, Blake Clark's kid? And I went, yeah. He goes, well, it's not his joke. And I was like, then why would you pick all the people in the world? Why would you pick that one?
Right. Oh my God. That's like karma. That's beautiful. they have a hack confronted by the son of the originator of the joke. I don't want to focus too much on your dad because you've had a great career as well, but I did want to ask, Jim Varney, was that somebody your dad came up with, or was that somebody you met out here?
It was somebody he met out here, as I understand it. They did a weird movie together called Fast Food in the mid-80s. Uh-huh. I don't know if you can find that anywhere, but I knew they were friends from that. I don't know if they knew. No, they must have known each other before that. Just from the way, as I understand it, the Comedy Store worked back then. Like, you know, you just kind of knew everybody who was around at that point.
Right.
You know? And especially when the way my dad tells the story is that you had to pick which club you played at. If you played at the Improv, you weren't going to play at the Comedy Store. If you played at the Comedy Store, you weren't going to play at the Improv. And, you know, it was, you kind of, there was a line in the sand kind of thing.
Right.
So yeah, he knew Jim from that. And then there was that odd thing that when Varney passed away, my dad got to become the voice of Slinky Dog, which
right.
is still one of the coolest things. You know, he has all of this success in voiceover, and I like to, you know, I like to think that maybe I'm the reason he started that, because when I worked in animation, I hired him. I would write parts for him. And I used to work on, they relaunched the Woody Woodpecker show in the late 90s. Don't look for it. You didn't miss anything. But I wrote on it for 3 years. Uh-huh. And I wrote a couple of parts for my dad. And those were his first voiceover jobs, other than like ADR stuff or something that he would do. And then that kind of led him towards another fork in his career that he has had a lot of success in. So it's not my doing per se, but I like to think that, you know, I saw a plucky upstart and gave him a chance. You know, I think I helped out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I should mention Jim Varney is the guy who did the Ernest Saves Christmas, Ernest Goes to Camp,
yeah.
all those movies. Really talented guy and just a very talented actor. I think he was like Shakespearean.
He was a Shakespearean actor. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't, to use the stereotype, it wasn't dumb redneck. He was like a very talented actor who just found his niche and did these local commercials. Ivern, and they blew
yeah.
up. And he blew up, and you know, what an amazing career. But that's great that your dad ended up getting the part that was meant for Jim all those years later.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of a funny way. I guess it's just like anything else. You know, it's you stay in it long enough, eventually something comes up for you.
Yeah. So walk me through a little bit. So you go from the Wiener Factory. You're out of college. Where'd you go to college?
I went to Carnegie Mellon for about a year and a half, almost 2 years. And then we both agreed we should see other places. Like it was Carnegie Mellon is 20% fine arts and 80% like very technical robotics and architecture and all of that stuff. So mm-hmm. I went to acting school there. And I mean, I went to school with like a lot of really talented people, some of whom went on to be like pretty successful. And some of whom I still, one of whom I still work with to this day, and one of whom I live down the street from and am friends with and have been friends with since high school. So it's,
oh, wow.
it's funny how that all worked out. So I went there. It was very expensive. We didn't really have the money. Then the 94 earthquake happened and we really didn't have the money. So I moved back home right at the time when the school was like, we think you're pretty emotionally unstable. And I was like, you are right. You nailed it. So I came back home. The earthquake happened. My girlfriend's younger brother worked at the Wiener Factory because he was still in high school, or maybe he was just out. But I was just like, you think they would let they'd hire me? So I went there.
Carnegie Mellon.
From Carnegie Mellon to the Wiener Factory, which is really just, now that you put it, you frame it that way, is exactly the type of career moves I've made my whole life. It's just like, I'm here, but now I'm here, and now I'm here, and now I'm here.
And
so
you're at the Wiener Factory, and then you start going toward the auditions and stuff, or?
Well, I had an agent, and I the reason I took the Wiener Factory job is I could schedule the late shift. I could work dinner and go off and do auditions during the day and then go sell hot dogs at night.
That hot dog dinner crowd is always it's always a hot crowd.
You know, the California dream. So I'm auditioning for stuff. I get close to getting Friends at one point. I like go in for Chandler several times. They went with some other guy. I don't know if it worked out for him. You know, that would have totally changed my life if I had been Chandler on Friends.
A little bit.
Yeah, I mean, like, unbelievably different. But, you know, for about 2 or 3 years, I felt like I was close to getting something, but then I never really sealed the deal. Then I hurt my back super bad. I blew out my back weightlifting, like, just like literally ruptured a disc. Like, there's these discs between your vertebrae and they're filled with like kind of jelly donut type liquids. Right. And usually people in their like 40s and 50s herniate them as you age. At 19, I exploded mine. The whole thing just shot open.
Oh my God.
Are
you deadlifting or what was it?
No, it was leg pressing. I had like, my legs were always incredibly strong. And I loaded up like a ton. I loaded up a ton of weight. I think I had 1,000 pounds. No, probably under 1,000. I had like 700 or 800 pounds on there. And I was like, I'm going to just really just max it out, bro. Super gains.
Jesus.
And there was this weird noise that happened. And then I've been chasing surgery ever since. So that kind of made everything go left for a while. Uh-huh. So I had to leave to go have this surgery for my back, and the recovery was several months. The Wiener Factory does not have a health program, does not cover leave of absence or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So I go away for 3 months. I come back. I'm kind of better. I'm like, hey guys, I'm ready to work. And they're like, yeah, we don't really need you. We're good.
Brutal. Wiener Factory in Hollywood.
Right. So I go and get a job as a security guard guarding houses close to where I live with my folks. There's like this company. So I have a little outfit. I sit in a shack. At the time, I get super into rollerblading because I can't run anymore because my back's all messed up. But I'm like, oh, I'm going to rollerblade for like exercise. Mm-hmm. I fall down a hill rollerblading.
Jeez.
And looks like I fell off a motorcycle. I had to go to the emergency room. They thought I fell off a motorcycle because I was going really fast when I fell.
Oh my God.
So now I'm having to recover from back surgery and from falling on rollerblades. So I get fired from the security guard job because I like am laying on the ground, like bandaged, like I just left the gate open to let people drove in. I didn't care. So I get fired from that job. I get rehired at the Wiener Factory because they find out that they need me. But then now I'm also working security at Jerry's Famous Deli at night. So now I'm not auditioning at all. I'm selling hot dogs during the day and I'm guarding a deli at night. That's my life.
This is from Chandler on Friends too.
Exactly.
Oh my God. Brutal.
Yeah.
Did your parents say you were a reckless kid? I mean, both like putting 1,000 pounds and like falling down. Were you always like jumping the big wheel over the car?
Yeah, I was kind of that kid. I used to like, you know, try and jump my bike all the time. Or going back to when I said I liked Greatest American Hero, what I liked about it was he would try and fly and couldn't do it. So I thought that was really funny. So I'd get on furniture and just jump and try and fly like him and fall and hit stuff. And my parents too were like, we'd put you in the crib when you were a baby, but if you wanted to get out, there was no stopping you. Like you would jump out of the crib. So you just hear this thump. I just come running in the room and it's like, well, Travis is up. So yeah, I guess this was kind of hardwired in me.
Wow. That's yeah. What about, and you have a sister or you have a brother?
Brother. I have a younger brother who's 10 years younger than me. And so I don't think that was planned. No. But so remember when I was 5, I was like, I really want a younger brother because I had a lot of my friends had brothers and it seemed like it was really cool. Mm-hmm. And then by the time I was 10, my parents were like, guess what? You're gonna get that brother you always wanted. I'm like, I am 10. I want a dog and Nintendo. I do not care about a brother anymore. I have moved on.
Right. Too late.
Yeah.
What's your next step? You're going through all this stuff, the back or the rollerblading accident. How do you get back on your feet again?
So I'm in this acting class that was actually really, really helpful. It was run by this lady named Janet Ahanti, and she was like one of the big acting teachers. I don't know if she still teaches. She probably is retired by now. But mm-hmm. she taught like this really great class. I learned more in that class than I did going to college, but that's also because I was a little more receptive to learning. I was very angry in the little bit of time I was in college. Mm-hmm. And from that, all of these people in the class would always tell me, they're like, you're really funny. You should do comedy. Cause I was only trying to be like just intensely serious. Right. And I think what was happening was I was trying to be so serious that it was funny, even though I wasn't trying to be funny. So they were like, you should try, you know, the Groundlings, you should try improv, you should try that stuff. So I went and I did improv at the Groundlings for a while. And I went through the classes kind of quickly for a while. And I met like a lot of really cool people. And this one lady, Diane, that I worked, that I was in class with, worked in animation. And so the way kind of all of those classes work is you have to kind of get together with people whenever it works out for them. So I had to go to her job one time and like try and write some silly sketch. But here I am surrounded by like all these people working on the Hulk cartoon in like 1996. Mm-hmm. So to me, I'm like, this is amazing. This is like, you get to sit around and just like talk about and think about superheroes nonstop. And she's like, yeah. I was like, could I work here? And she's like, I guess. So I ended up working as a delivery person for the studio for a while.
Wow.
So if people needed, you know, it's funny, it's 1996. So faxes and email existed, but not to the way that we can use them now, because I would have to like literally drive giant storyboards to other people. I'd have to deliver giant reams of paper and stuff to people and collect stuff and make sure everybody had. And now sometimes we'd have to pick up actual film from LAX that had been shot in Korea where they animated it. And then they'd have to pick it up and deliver it to the editors. And so from there, I ended up working as a production assistant at a different company. From then I ended up working at a production assistant at Universal. And then while I was working at Universal, they were relaunching that Woody Woodpecker cartoon that I was telling you about. And they were having a huge problem with their writers. Like they wanted this like wacky, crazy show. And they were hiring all the people who'd worked on some shows that were really funny, but really not for children.
Right.
And then they decided halfway through that this children's program was too aggressively messed up to be for children. Right. And the writers didn't like that. And I was like, I don't know, I could probably write one. And then that was my job for 3.5 years is I wrote Woody Woodpecker for 3 years.
Oh my God. The old, I remember watching that as a kid, Walter Lantz, Woodpecker, and yeah, that's pretty iconic.
It was a cool character to get to work on. And our, even though the show didn't do that great, our voice cast was amazing. The main characters of Woody and Wally, who's Wally Walrus is like Woody Woodpecker's foil, if you ever watch it. And we had Billy West playing both parts. Billy West is an enormous, he was Ren and Stimpy on the Ren and Stimpy show. He used to do all these voices for Howard Stern. He's just one of the best voiceover people in the world. Mm-hmm. There, and still to this day. And then Buzz Buzzard was played by Mark Hamill. I got to work with Mark Hamill, and you know, I grew up as this enormous Star Wars fan. Like before I'd go to work, I'd go to Toys R Us and buy whatever Star Wars toys were out. Cause there was, and so I got to meet Mark Hamill. I freaked out. I freaked him out by how much I freaked out, you know, but he was really kind and very cool about it. First day I met him, I said, I always thought you were this big. And I showed, you know, like the size of an action figure, and he went, what? And I went, I don't know. And then
Well, good thing you had some time with him.
Exactly.
One meeting and you're just like, well, that's forever. Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Luke Skywalker.
And he's such a great actor. And so I ended up doing a couple of voices on Woody Woodpecker. So I got to work with him, and I was so nervous, and I messed up this one read, and he couldn't have been nicer or more kind or more supportive or more like, oh, you know, I never direct people, but I really liked the way you first did that. You should do that again. And I was like, whatever you want, man. You got it.
That's awesome. And so you were there for 3 years, and did you continue in the voice over or writing, or would you?
I continued in writing. So at the same time, one of the things that came out of me doing the Groundlings was I ended up, through a girl I was in class with, ended up dating a one of her friends, and I ended up in a theater troupe with all of these people. So I'm in this theater troupe that was at the time grassroots and kind of grew into being a thing that is pretty, it's been around now for 20 some years. So there's a company called the Troubadour Theater Company. We're kind of known for taking music and Shakespeare and putting them together. So we always have like very punny titles. So we did Fleetwood Macbeth, Comedy of Aerosmith, ELO Othello, stuff like that, you know. So we did a lot of these things very early on, and I became part of that troupe. So then that troupe went on to become kind of a resident at Gary Marshall's theater in Burbank, which was at the time called the Falcon Theater, now called the Gary Marshall Theater. Mm-hmm. So we went from being like performing on the grass lawn at Santa Monica High to performing in a real theater. And then it just kind of kept growing and kept growing. So I'm doing, now I'm writing cartoons during the day and doing Shakespeare at night. That's become my job. Then the cartoons end. Now I'm writing for TBS. Used to have all of these wraparound shows where they'd show you a movie, some usually Steven Seagal movie. And then it's like, yeah, so we had dinner and a movie, man-made movie, guy with, movies for guys.
With Paul Gilmartin.
Yes, Paul Gilmartin hosted dinner and a movie. So I worked on the construction version, which was man-made movie. So then we're showing you Hard to Kill, and we're installing a new screen door. And you know, like that's the episode, you know. sometimes we try and tie the movie to the project, but after a while it was like, we're watching Roadhouse for the fifth time and we're doing the driveway, you know, like it was,
you couldn't do it. Yeah.
you know, I tried to be funny with it or silly, but you're writing 15 minutes of content around a movie that should only take 90 minutes, but it's going to take 2.5 hours to watch by the time commercials and everything air.
Right.
So we would make those. I did that for 3-4 years. I did that for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then when that job ended, I had to have another back surgery because my back got all messed up again. Then it was recovery from that. I was like, I don't know, what do I do now? I have all of these very weird jobs. I have nowhere to really go. Like, I can't transfer writing a cartoon into getting a TV writing job. I can't transfer writing man-made movie into writing features. Like, it's right. I'm kind of in this weird little narrow area. Right. So stand up it is. Let's get into stand up.
Wow. And you had no previous stand up experience before getting into it?
No, I mean, just doing, I really, so when I was 22, my dream was to become an SNL cast member. That's what I wanted. I wanted to do sketches and characters and all of that stuff. That's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I ran at that for a really long time. And now I think I've realized that's not going to happen. I think I'm okay with it. I think it's fine.
Right.
But that was the type of comedy I wanted. I was like, oh, it's different than what my dad does. It's different than what, you know, what I grew up around. I can do a different version of it. And then it turns out I couldn't. It turns out I wasn't that great at it.
But did you feel your dad was too mainstream, or did you
I think it's just that young person thing of, I don't want to do what my dad does, or at least that's what it was for me. Nothing against my dad or what my dad did. I just wanted to be different. I wanted to be like, I didn't want it to be expected to go doing exactly the same thing my dad did. Mm-hmm. And in hindsight, who gives a crap? If you have a passion for it, go and do it. Who cares?
Yeah. So how long did you do the stand-up, and did you and your dad, I know you did a couple of shows like in Vegas together. I remember.
Yeah. And Vegas and Reno, we did a couple of shows together. I really started at the bottom. Like I'd go to whatever open mic I could. I would, like I was telling you earlier, I never mentioned who my dad was. Mm-hmm. Not that I think it would have gotten me anything, to be honest, but I think it was just one of those, like, can I stand on my own two feet and do this myself without any, you always hear people complain about nepotism or someone getting a shot that they don't deserve. And mm-hmm. I guess that was, now that I'm talking about it out loud, I think that was something I was scared of. Like, I didn't want people to think that about me. And right. then once you do comedy long enough, you realize people are going to find all kinds of reasons not to like you or say you don't deserve what you got or that you don't deserve whatever opportunity you have. Right. Who your dad is or what your family is probably going to be the least of your worries.
Right. And it stifles your creativity too. I always thought, like, I wanted to be a certain type of performer. But then I was coming up with material that wasn't necessarily in that way. I loved Andy Kaufman. I loved Steve Martin. I loved absurdity. But then after a while, I was like, well, I also like just weird observations that I made. And like,
right.
So it's like, why am I pushing these ideas away when it's like, I can still make it the personality I want, but I'm just bringing my own persona along with Steve Martin and Andy Kaufman to that. So I think, yeah, you don't want to limit yourself just because, well, this is what my dad does. And if I do this, then people are going to say this. And then you're just in your head. And that's where you lose your creativity.
Yeah. And I think that was a huge problem with my stand-up was I had all of that going on. And even though maybe that wasn't informing what I was talking about, it was definitely informing my opinion of myself or my opinion of how I needed to be. And, you know, it ended up making me make really strange choices in terms of what I did want to talk about or what I did want to do. Mm-hmm. Or I was like, I'm going to be hyper specific and just talk about this one really narrow thing that like maybe two other people will get. And it turns out that's a super bummer for somebody who came to see a comedian perform. It's like, yeah. I remember doing a show in Reno and I was doing all of this stuff about like a hyper specific band and guitars. And there was a guy with long hair sitting in the front row. And I was like, you know what I'm talking about? And he goes, I don't know what, can I curse? Are you not?
Yeah,
yeah. He goes, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. And I went, yep, that checks out.
Yeah, Reno will let you know where you stand.
Right away. Reno doesn't have time for you. Yeah.
Yeah, the Silver Legacy, right? Was that at the Silver?
Yeah, the Silver Legacy. I loved that place. There's no bathroom in there. So it's like if you had to time your sets to run across the casino.
Yeah, it's such. I once had the sound guy once fell asleep during my set. So that was
unbelievable.
That was before it was, I forgot what it was. It's been so many things.
It was Catch a Rising Star, and that's now right. It's the Laugh Factory. If right. it's, I don't even know if it's still there. Actually, I don't know if they still have that.
It is still there, and they give you, they give you buffet tickets. I think buffet tickets.
Yeah, they give you weird meal vouchers that you have to go use in that weird food court. I loved it.
And you have like 6 days to like just eat whatever horrible dreams you have of eating. It's Reno is great. But and then I was disappointed because then the two of us were going to be in Fully Formed Adults, which was a web series.
Yeah.
I think we did the table read together with Scott Boxenbaum, who's a great guy, who created the series. And had you been in a previous, this was season two, I think.
Yeah, I was in. I was in two episodes in season one. I just played. I don't know if Scott wrote the role thinking about me or if he wrote the role and was like, I know who could nail that. It was this guy obsessed with being with music in the 90s and only talking about the 90s, which was very much who I am. So I did this one episode where I was supposed to go on a date with a girl and we'd met off of like a Jewish dating site. But like, I wasn't Jewish. I was just using it as a way to like meet girls. And so we go to this Seder meal and I'm like railing against this family and telling them that they're just buying into this story that's not real. And I had a lot of fun with the part. Uh-huh. And so he brought me back for a second episode. And then, yeah, we were going to do season two, but I had just gotten a job producing for Spotify, which is my job I do now. I produce some of their scripted podcasts. I had just started. And so I was like, look, I still really want to do this, but I'm busy. I'm literally in a studio from these times. And then I don't know if they made the guy a different guy or if they just recast me, but
I can't remember, but yeah, it was fun. I mean, we shot it right before the pandemic, I think, January 2020, and then he finished it and then got it all edited. And then, you know, I that's, it was good and bad, I guess. I guess maybe he was able to get it off to a streaming site, a small streaming site. I think it streamed a little bit, but yeah, the timing was awful on because he wanted to have like a viewing for it and all that.
Right.
But yeah.
Also too, you guys were doing, like when we did it, we did the season one was just kind of like, whenever there was a script, we'd get together and do it. You guys tried to do all of season two, like quickly, right? Like all together.
Yeah. He shot them all back to back. And I was in the final episode, which is great. I use it on my reel. It's my, I'm speaking at a eulogy for one of the characters and the husband. And it was, he just let me play. And it was so much fun. But yeah, it's called Fully Formed Adults. If anyone wants to check that out, it's probably, I think it's on YouTube, but I know it's on, I don't think I have a Facebook page. But yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the podcast. You have, this is sort of where you found your niche finally. Do you feel like you finally found your groove in the podcast producing and area?
Sort of. I mean, I it's definitely one of those things I just not fell into. So in 2011, I was recovering from yet another back surgery. And this one took over a year to recover from. So I had an artificial joint put in my spine in 2010. So, and then they also grafted two other of my vertebrae together. So they fused a level. So that took, I don't think it was probably 18 months start to finish before I was fully recovered from that.
Wow.
So during that time, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't go anywhere. I was on this, all this crazy pain medication. I lost a good 6 or 7 years of my life to just being in chronic pain and being unable to do anything. Mm-hmm. So I had these microphones laying around my house. I had an interface from like when I thought I was going to try and record music, and I had just gotten married. I'd been married for about a year at that point. And I thought my wife was really funny. I still think she's really funny, but she's one of those people who's just, the way she sees the world makes me laugh. I find it really funny because she's so upbeat and I'm kind of so gloom and doom, and she kind of is just fun. She makes me laugh. Right. So we made a show about that, just us being a couple and kind of talking about our lives. And we did that for 4 years every week, which is really hard. And I learned just so much doing that and had a lot of fun. And the show got featured on Apple a few times, and we kind of, you know, for an independent show in 2011, when shows were like, podcasts are so much more not difficult to explain to people now. Like, I don't know if you've had that experience when you promote this, like,
right.
But if you say I have a podcast, people know what that means.
Right.
My experience in 2011 was I literally had someone say, I like your audio blog. And I went, no, that's not what it is. That's okay. Thank you. But that's not what it is.
Right. And just to say, you're the show is called The Odd Conversations, right?
It was a Tiny Odd Conversations was tiny that show. Yeah. And that was what started this snowball of like, well, I like doing this. I like making these. I like just kind of stream of conscious talking about things. Mm-hmm. So then that led to me getting, so we ended that show in 2016. Then I got hooked up with Adam Todd Brown, who runs the Unpopular Opinion Network. So there we started doing all of these shows about bands. The first one we did was Heart-Shaped Pod, which was all about Nirvana. So we, for like 40 episodes, just talked about every stage of Nirvana's history of being in a band and like what happened, and we found all of these weird moments. Then we added our buddy Andy Sell to the mix, and we decided to go from from Nirvana to Limp Bizkit, which was originally supposed to be an April Fool's joke. We're going to make one episode of this show as an April Fool's joke that we're like, the Nirvana guys went on to Limp Bizkit.
Right.
The show charted, like it was like top 100 like the day it came out. Wow. We're like, okay. So we made a whole season about doing Limp Bizkit. And like, I am not a Limp Bizkit fan. And we had to go through and analyze all of their records. And that ended with us going, hey, man, you know what we should do? Let's do Korn next. And then we did two seasons of a Korn podcast called Pod the Life. And man, I was not a fan of Korn before, and I remain not a fan of Korn after going through all 13 of their records.
Right. Well, did you watch the documentary on their guitarist?
No. The one that that found Jesus and came back?
Yeah. It's pretty it was good. I just found that whole tale fascinating of him kind of changing his life and kind of did, kind of didn't. I don't know. And did it for his daughter.
He found God, left the band, realized he liked making money, came back to the band, and now it's been in the band for like, I think he was gone for 6 years, has been back for 10 or something like that.
Right. And he married his wife that he had the kid with is a white supremacist. She married a white supremacist.
What?
Yes. Like a skinhead. So that's an issue. I didn't know you didn't.
No, you would think. You would think the deep dive that we took on Korn, that would have come up. We did drink Korn coffee, which I can tell you is awful. Do not drink Korn coffee, spelled with all K's.
But you got to think that over if you're going to.
Yeah, I know. Like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Especially if your wife married a white supremacist, that's bad.
I had a friend who grew up in Bakersfield. He was a comedian. I don't know if you know him, Craig Coleman.
I know the name, but I don't know him. No, yeah.
He was basically a roadie for Korn in the early days in Bakersfield. And
amazing.
Yeah. And it's just fascinating, that group. I mean, yeah, Korn and Limp Bizkit. What was the Limp Bizkit podcast called? Did you have
one? That was called $3 Pod, y'all.
$3 Pod.
Then we did one on Oasis called Podcast Supernova. Uh-huh. And that was a lot of fun. And I think we're getting ready to, we haven't done a show together, all three of us, in over a year, because Andy moved away and then the pandemic happened. Mm-hmm. And then, so I think we're getting ready to do a new one on Steve Earle. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's a really interesting singer, songwriter, and actor. So I think we're going to talk about outlaw country in the 70s and do a whole show about that. Nice.
Christopherson
and David Allen Coe and Earl and all of those that weird subsect that kind of happened in like 72, it seems.
Yeah, that was such a great era of music. I mean, especially, like, I'm not a country fan, but that era, I mean, I think that was when country meant something. Now it's like shiny pants and, like, you know, it's like so wimpy now. And like back then it was like, these are real whiskey drinking, like hard times, like shot somebody.
Yeah. Shot a man outside of Reno just to watch him die. I don't doubt that you did that.
Right. Well, that would be a really great deep dive. I'd love to.
I think it'll be fun. I'm looking forward to it. But I mean, as you know, making a pod, I don't know what people think making a podcast is like, but if it's done well, it seems like it's not a lot of work. But when you really make one, it takes a lot of time. It's a labor of love.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Spotify. So that's sort of your pet project. That's sort of something you do to enjoy and with.
Yeah. The Steve Earle and the music stuff and all of that, that stuff I do for fun. And, you know, we have, the Unpops Network has a really great fan base, and they've all been really kind and cool. A lot of them are legit friends of mine, either online or in person. They're just really fun people. I've met a lot of them. Some of them come out to California just to see our stand-up shows when we do them or when we did them. So it's a really cool community of people. But my day job is basically voice directing for Spotify. Spotify owns several different studios. I work for one called Parcast, and all of our shows are fully researched and scripted. And I'm not doing the voices, and I didn't write them, but I make sure that the lines are said and that they make sense and all of that stuff. That's my
sort of a director.
Sort of a director. They call us line producers, which is a funny name to me, because if you work in production at all, a line producer is the person who does budgets and secures locations and figures out shoot dates and whatever. I'm called a line producer, and that I make sure the lines are produced. I make sure what's on the page is said by one of our narrators and that it makes sense.
Right. So yeah, sort of just a different interpretation of the line.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember listening to Mark Duplass, and that's one thing he talked about during the pandemic was more almost TV shows moving to podcasts, where it becomes like you're listening to a TV show. So I feel like it's almost going back to the olden days of radio.
It is
what you're seeing, or
yeah, I mean that's it's definitely, well, it's funny. There's kind of two trends that I see going on right now, because almost every day you'll look and you'll see some very famous person is doing a scripted series, and they're doing some, you know, really neat show idea that if you made it into a movie or a TV series would cost millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. You do it on audio, the listener imagines what it looks like, and then you kind of do proof of concept. So you see some of these things, like Homecoming is a one that comes to mind, that started off as a scripted podcast that became a show, and then the show did really well, and then you got, you know, the Dirty John, which became a movie and a series. These things that people just take interest in and gets developed and becomes something else. So you really do take that step back to kind of old Hollywood, where you can make something for not a lot of money, but it can be really high concept or really weird or really out there or really well researched. And yeah, it's neat. And it kind of goes back to, like, you know, where I first found my footing, which was in animation, which was all about what can I put on the page that then can get drawn and become something else. We don't actually have to try and make this thing. It can just be imaginary.
Right.
And so that's gotten me really into voice acting again. I kind of hadn't done any voice acting for about, I don't know, 5 years. Oh, maybe six. No, what was that? 4 years. 4 years ago was the last time I did something. And so now I'm re kind of like super energized by that. Like, I really want to, I enjoy directing and doing what I do, but I really want to be the guy, you know, telling you like the new Chevy Dodge, you know, whatever the thing. I really want to be the guy doing the voice. I think it's a lot of fun.
That's awesome. It seems like there's a quote from Johnny Carson. Like, Johnny said to Steve Martin one time, he said, you will do everything you know. Like, meaning like Steve Martin had been a magician at Disneyland and learned all the magic tricks. He was a cheerleader, and he sort of used that. And it's the same for you, like all these things you learned early on in your career. It's like, why the hell am I learning this? And then how it comes into play later on in your life. Like it's sort of like just trust the process, I guess.
Yeah, it really is. And there's also too that thing, I forget who said it, but it's, you know, don't keep pushing on the doors that don't budge, push on the doors that open, push on the ones that, you know, I sat there and I pushed on a lot of doors that they were like, they stayed very firmly in place. And I was like, I just got to run at this hard enough. And as I've said, I've had 5 back surgeries. I should leave heavy things alone.
Right. Don't run into things. Yeah, that's true. That's something I learned at stand-up, is like, so often we're trying to get into places that clearly don't want anything to do with us for whatever reason. And well, you'll never figure it out. So there's people that love to work with you. So focus
exactly
on people. Like, why spend that energy on that other stuff? Because, you know, you can have just as successful of a career not following the route that, you know, maybe Richard Pryor followed or whatever. You can have just as successful if you're doing what you love. That's really the main thing, especially as I get older, I learn that, you know.
Same. And also too, like, chasing what's popular or a trend, like if your passion isn't aligned up with that, if you're just like, well, that's popular now, I guess I'll do that. Like, remember when puppets were having a moment in comedy and everybody had to have a puppet for a while?
Right.
I was like, well, there's one guy who's the puppet guy. Like, if you're not him, don't have a puppet. Just do your own thing, man.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good thing about you doing the audio blog back in 2010. I'm sure at the time you're like, I don't know what this is, but it's like you like talking to your wife and you like her stories, and it became something, and it led to this further career of understanding podcasts and helping other people with their lines and understanding it.
Yeah, and it's the thing that I found about, you know, if you'd have told me when I started podcasts, because I had goals, my goals when I started in 2011 and my goals now are, they're so different, but I couldn't have gotten to where I am now without that weird first step. Even if my goal was, I want to be as popular as Marc Maron in the podcast space, which I think was probably something along the lines of what I thought. Mm-hmm. I never achieved that, but I achieved so many other things and learned so many other things. And I'm still finding ways to navigate this space and finding other ways to find fulfillment and find interesting and do work and work with people that I really enjoy working with. That's huge in and of itself. You know, that's so much more of, like you were saying, trust the process. You know, it's, there's something to the madness if you're really pursuing something you care about.
Yeah, that's so true. Thank you so much for being on the show. And I'm so happy that we finally connected.
Me too.
And hopefully we'll cross paths again in the podcasting world.
I hope so.
Where are some places people can check you out? Would any plugs you want to give?
You can, if you're interested in following me on Twitter or Instagram, I'm at Track Rivals, TRACKRIV as in Victor, ALS, because every version of my name was taken. So I had to do an anagram of my name.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. There was for a while a preacher who had at Travis Clark on Twitter. And anytime I would do like these really weird stand-up shows, they would tag him. And so this very youth-oriented preacher would be like, come to the back of this strip club and watch Travis Clark do comedy. And people were like, what? So that's where you can find me online. And that's usually where I talk about any stuff I have going on.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to, because I was looking you up before the show and, yeah, isn't there also a singer named Travis Clark?
Yeah, from a band called We the Kings. Every now and then people will follow me and they're like, love the new album. I'm like, no, you don't. Not, I mean, you do, but you don't love mine. That's not what you're doing.
Right. Being a musician, you can just start pushing your records under Travis Clark. Take advantage. Thank you so much, Travis. Really great talking to you. And check out all of Travis's stuff. Keep listening to the podcast. Remember, leave us a nice review and subscribe to our friends.